Hi, I'm Steve Engelberg, Editor-in-Chief of ProPublica. Welcome to the podcast. If you've been following the affirmative action case currently before the Supreme Court, you probably have the impression that the plaintiff, Abigail Fisher, is a textbook victim of reverse discrimination. She's been widely portrayed as a solid student with decent scores who was rejected for a spot at the University in Texas and Austin, while minorities with lesser qualifications were admitted under an affirmative action program. Our reporter, Nicole Hannah-Jones, took a look at the court documents in Fisher v. University of Texas and found a very different narrative. Race, those documents showed, was hardly a factor in her rejection by the university. We sat down in our trusty storage closet studio on Tuesday, March 19th, to learn more. Nicole, you recently brought to light some fascinating facts about a very important affirmative action case, Fisher versus University of Texas. Why should people care about this case?
Fisher versus the University of Texas is a case challenging whether or not colleges can use race as one of several factors in determining admission. So why people should care is the court could ultimately rule that affirmative action is no longer allowed in colleges, and that would take away one of the tools that colleges have to ensure diversity of their student body.
Gee, I thought affirmative action was already pretty limited in colleges.
That's right. Affirmative action has been limited pretty substantially by the Supreme Court over about 30 years of case law. At this point, the only means that universities can use affirmative action for is to ensure diversity. And so they can use it in a very narrow way. It can't be kind of the main thrust behind an admissions decision, but it is allowed.
So Abigail Fisher, who is she and what was her case about?
Abigail Fisher was a student from Sugar Land, Texas, and she applied to the University of Texas in 2008. She was denied admission. University of Texas has a admission program called the Top 10%, whereas it lets in the top 10% of students in their high school classes automatically, and that leaves very few spaces for students who didn't graduate in the top 10%. Abigail Fisher was one of those students. So she applied for a limited number of spaces, and she was denied admission. Abigail Fisher then sued the University of Texas, saying that she was denied a space at university because she was white.
Now, when I've read the stories about this, she comes across as quite a sympathetic plaintiff. I mean, she says that she was going to high school and she got pretty good grades and good scores, and then just because of her race, she didn't get into college. Now, you dug into the court documents in this case and came across a different picture. What did you find?
What's interesting, when I was reading the reports about this case, one of the questions I kept asking myself was, how would any student know what the grades were of other students who either got accepted or rejected from a university? I didn't understand how anyone could know that. I applied to college, and I have no idea whether other students with better or worse grades than me got in. So I started reading the court documents, and what I found out is, one, Abigail Fisher, she was unlikely to have challenged her denial, but there was a man who was looking for plaintiffs to challenge affirmative action across the nation, and he actually sought out Abigail Fisher. And when you read the court documents, you find out that there were actually plenty of white students with lower grades than Abigail Fisher who were denied, and there were dozens of Black and Latino students with higher grades than Abigail Fisher who were also denied.
So the problem that she had, if I understand it correctly, is that she is in one of these situations where the top 10% of each high school go in Texas. That's the way it works. But she wasn't in the top 10% at her high school.
She wasn't. She was in the top 12%. But it was a very strong class of applicants the year that Abigail Fisher applied. Once you took out the students who got in under the top 10%, they were actually the kids vying for the remaining 840 spots were being rejected at a higher rate than students applying to Harvard that year. So Abigail Fisher, while her grades were pretty good, they really weren't great considering the level of competition for those spots. And what the University of Texas claims, and actually what the man behind Abigail Fisher's suit also admits, is that race probably had little to do with Abigail Fisher's denial, and there's no way to show that race had anything to do with it.
But nonetheless, if the court rules in her favor, this is going to have a very significant effect on the American education system, isn't it?
Yeah, it could. There's really three ways that the court could rule on this. The court could rule very narrowly and just say University of Texas affirmative action program is too broad or unnecessary and therefore it's violating the Constitution. Or it could have a more large impact and say that affirmative action programs in any public universities are illegal. And many people think that that's what this court is leaning towards doing because affirmative action was decided just a decade ago, and the University of Texas program is really designed after the program that was upheld by the Supreme Court 10 years ago. So many believe that the justices would not have granted cert on this case if they didn't intend to overturn it. And then there's a pretty slim possibility, but what some people are concerned about is that the justices could use this case to overturn any race-conscious programs used by government in any manner, in employment, in contracting, in education. And that obviously could have a huge impact on the ability to kind of address racial inequities.
Now, we did have some oral arguments in this case. You know, it's always hard to tell what's going to happen in a case by watching the oral arguments, but what was your sense? Did you have a sense of how the justices might be leaning?
So most people believe that the most conservative justices were going to be very, very skeptical of this and that the more liberal justices were going to be leaning towards upholding it. And that was borne out in the oral arguments. There's kind of Justice Kennedy is that vote that people aren't really sure of. He's the one who has said that he doesn't believe that the Constitution bans outright any use of race in admissions, but that it should be very, very narrow. So people are really looking at his vote. When you look at Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Antonin Scalia, their questioning made it pretty clear where they stand. Antonin Scalia and Chief Justice have both said that they don't believe race-conscious remedies are any different than Jim Crow law. But Kennedy's questioning was also very interesting because he kept asking, does race count above all? And people believe that because he was so concerned that race was seeming to be the predominant factor, that he actually may be willing to strike this down.
Although your reporting suggests race was not the predominant factor.
No, race was definitely not the predominant factor in Abigail Fisher. And interestingly enough, one of the concerns that the more conservative justices had was that a middle class or upper class black student would take the slot of a lower income white student because race is that important. But what they failed to note is that socioeconomic status gets kind of equal weight as race. So you could be a poor white student and you would actually get credit for being poor. And actually, you could be a white student and get credit for race too. So one of the things that was brought up in oral arguments by University of Texas and the federal government was that a white student who went to maybe a majority black or Latino school could also get credit for his or her race because that would have an impact on that student.
Now, you point out a historical irony here, or at least a fascinating aspect of this case. It turns on the 14th Amendment, a part of our Constitution that had a significant impact on the original 20th century fight for civil rights. Talk a little bit about what the 14th Amendment meant in the original famous cases and now how it's being used today.
This is one of the aspects of the case that I found to be the most fascinating. So the 14th Amendment was passed. It's considered one of the Reconstruction Amendments, and it was passed right after the 13th Amendment. 13th Amendment, of course, abolished slavery. And after slavery was abolished, you started having different Southern officials enacting black codes and trying to enact different laws that would basically keep slavery alive, even though slavery was illegal. So the 14th Amendment was passed to ensure the rights of newly freed black Americans. And now the 14th Amendment is being used in a very different way. So what you started seeing in the civil rights movement, when we had de facto segregation, you had civil rights groups, chiefly the NAACP, arguing that the Constitution required colorblindness. 14th Amendment is known as the Equal Protection Law, and it's saying that all people have equal protection under the law. So they began to use that argument to attack segregation in schools, in interstate commerce, in every aspect of society, and they were successful. So now you have 45 years later, you have conservatives using that same colorblind argument to then attack those programs that came out of the civil rights movement. So what they're saying is that because the Constitution requires colorblindness, that means you can't take race into consideration at all, whether you're using race to help a minority group or you're using race to harm a minority group.
Now, your story points out we've literally come full circle here. That is to say that one of the most important early cases in the civil rights movement involved the University of Texas.
Yes. So in 1946, a man by the name of Herman Marion Sweat applied to the University of Texas Law School. He met all of the admissions requirements, but he was denied entry because at that time, the state of Texas mandated that black and white kids could not attend the same schools. So the NAACP challenged that law. And at that point, they were challenging really that the law of the land at that time was separate but equal. NAACP said, this isn't equal because there's no black law school. The state of Texas then tried to create a black law school within a couple of months. And the Supreme Court said, no, that a newly created law school is not going to be equal to this school with this long storied past and alumnus. And so they knocked it down and forced University of Texas to accept its first black student. And that kind of paved the way for a ruling that would come 4 years later, which everyone knows, of course, which is Brown versus Board of Education. And that ruling then knocked down legal school segregation across the country.
I have to ask, because it just seems so odd, what kind of law school did they create in a couple of months? What did it consist of?
Well, it was basically kind of a couple classrooms at a black university, and it had a couple faculty, and they were saying, now we have a law school.
And a single student.
A single student, though I'm sure they would eventually admit other students. And that school actually did become a full-fledged school. It's now named after Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, was the first black justice of the Supreme Court. But at the time, the court saw through what they were trying to do. And the case was seen as being so, landmark because what the court was saying was just creating a facility doesn't bring equality. It has to be equal in every way, which means has to be equal in terms of resources. It has to be equal in terms of access. And so people knew that that was going to be the end of segregation.
So Abigail Fisher, I don't want to lose track of Abigail Yes. Fisher in this story. So she didn't get into the University of Texas at Austin. And so where'd she go?
She ended up going to her second choice, which was Louisiana State University. And this was part of the story that I didn't cover as much. But what's interesting is many people believe that Abigail Fisher, because she really wasn't harmed by this decision, the Supreme Court shouldn't have granted cert in the case in the first place, that she couldn't bring standing, she hadn't proved harm, and that she actually graduated from LSU and is now working in finance in Austin. And so therefore, there's no plaintiff who's currently being hurt.
Well, what were her damages in this case? If she got into college anyway, so how was she harmed?
Well, for the opportunity to overturn affirmative action in the nation, she's asked for a return of $100, which is $50 for her admissions fee and $50 for a housing deposit.
That's the damages.
That's the damages.
And it's interesting to note, because I think she argued in this case that being an LSU Tiger as opposed to a Longhorn at the University of Texas is going to significantly set back her hopes of eventually getting a job in her home state. Sounds like she did get a job in her home state.
Well, what she argued was that she may have gotten a better job had she graduated from University of Texas.
Seems hard to prove. Now, this gentleman, Blum, he's kind of a big character in this story, too. So Edward Blum, what's his role in all this? Why is he doing this?
So Edward Blum is a man who has kind of made it his mission in life to bring court challenges to any kind of race-conscious programs in the country. He believes that they violate the Constitution and that there shouldn't be what he calls preferential treatment of minority groups. So he's brought the University of Texas case. He also has another very well-known case before the Supreme Court, which is the one challenging key provision of the Voting Rights Act.
So how does he find these plaintiffs? Was he going on Craigslist, Facebook? How do you do that?
Yeah, he networks. He shops for plaintiffs. I mean, it's a tactic borrowed from civil rights groups. When civil rights groups wanted to challenge certain laws, they would shop for plaintiffs who they could use to challenge the laws. And he does the same thing. When he decided he wanted to challenge affirmative action, he put out the call that he was looking for plaintiffs who'd been rejected from University of Texas. And I think he actually met Abigail Fisher. He knew her father, and her father contacted him. Same thing for the Voting Rights Act. He was looking for counties that had some problems with the Voting Rights Act or felt that they were being constricted by the act. Shelby County had already sued and lost, and so he convinced them to appeal. And he provides pro bono representation for the plaintiffs for these suits.
And this is exactly what the civil rights advocates, Thurgood Marshall, NAACP, and so on, did in the 1950s.
That's right. I mean, there's no lack of irony in looking at a guy who is now working to dismantle a lot of the programs that came out of the civil rights movement is using the tactics of those groups that brought those gains.
Well, one last question. I mean, it is interesting to note that you have written a story very different from some other stories in this by sort of delving into the court documents and court papers. Was that particularly sort of difficult or arduous? Was it hard to figure all this out from the papers, or was it pretty much in plain text there?
No, I mean, it wasn't difficult. It's no more difficult than clicking on a court document. When I read it, I was kind of surprised because the court documents did seem to be giving a very different story than a lot of the coverage. But the case was made very plainly, and Edward Blum and Abigail Fisher's lawyers didn't spend a lot of time arguing that Abigail Fisher had been hurt. They made it very clear that they just didn't believe that the university should be using race at all in any context.
So it was hiding in plain sight.
It wasn't hiding.
Interesting. Well, Nicole, thank you very much for your time and your account of this case. We'll have to see what happens when the court rules.